This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
All right, everybody. Good evening. This is your host, Charles Giuliani, joining you again tonight. It's the People Speak Show. Very important guest, Kevin Barrett. Many of you are probably already familiar with his work. I've been interviewing him off and on quite a few times over the years. But I think it's been a good 2, maybe even 3 years since the last time I talked to him. So it's good to have him back on, get an update on what he's been up to lately. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Hey, thanks, Charles. Good to be back with you.
Why don't you, for our listeners, give yourself a quick introduction for those that aren't familiar with you.
Okay, well, I guess I'm probably best known as being that conspiracy professor. In 2006, Scholars for 9/11 Truth was growing very quickly. So Karl Rove, Lynn Cheney, and their cover-up team put out a hit on me through the Wisconsin State Legislature. And a guy named Steve Nass, who makes a living by beating up on the university, was charged with witch hunting me, trying to get me fired from my job teaching at the university, where I'd been teaching Arabic, folklore, Islamic studies, literature, stuff like that. And that particular semester, I was teaching an Islam course. So there was a huge hoopla, you know, academic freedom versus, you know, trying to get rid of the crazy conspiracy theorist. And that made me kind of, you know, well known. You know, not that anybody ever recognized my face. It's just that, you know, if something came up in the conversation, it would be, oh, that's you, the conspiracy professor. So that's how most people have heard of me. But since then, I've been doing my own radio show, writing a lot of op-eds and some satire for Veterans Today, where I'm an editor, and also Press TV, where I write op-eds, and I'm also a regular talking head. So that all keeps me pretty busy, and 9/11 Truth, of course, is, I figure, a long-term project, so I kind of keep my hand in that as well.
Excellent. I'm sure there's a lot of things you're going to probably want to talk about, but undoubtedly the most pressing issue on the mind of many minds of many people today right now is, you know, the fiasco going on in the Ukraine. Have you written any articles regarding that for Veterans Today?
Yeah, actually, I've been cranking stuff out on that quite a bit. I just did 2 satirical articles over at Veterans Today on Ukraine. One of them was something like, the headline was Americans Seek to Join Russian Federation, and trying to run Putin for president. and also, I think I did a top 10 reasons to keep intervening in Ukraine. That was another satire. You want to hear the top 10? Wait a second.
Sure.
I should be able to pull this up pretty quickly. Top 10 reasons for intervening in Ukraine.
I wish I had a little button I could press to have a drum roll.
yeah. Just it's gonna. Unfortunately, it's my computer's running a little slow right now. So I'm trying to pull it up. I think you're eating up all my bandwidth.
Oh, no.
That or the NSA is eating up my bandwidth.
Yeah, that's more likely the case.
Yeah, that's probably it. Well, geez, I'll give you this when it comes up.
Sure. I interviewed, now that you mentioned that, what was his name? Charles Strange, the father of Mike Strange. You know, the SEAL Team 6 fiasco.
Oh, there. Yeah.
Yeah, on the show a couple of weeks ago. And after him, the second half hour of the show, I had his computer tech on to talk about how he got in touch with him because he was having computer trouble. And sure enough, upon looking at the computer, he said he had installed on his computer the most high-tech, sophisticated spyware, to monitor every keystroke. And he said it's definitely government. And, of course, subsequent investigations revealed that his wife's computer had been hacked into, and there's a camera, apparently, that's installed somewhere in their home office that had been watching them. So,
wow. That sounds pretty serious, but I guess with him it would be, people like me, I don't really expect that kind of treatment because, you know, I don't have evidence that could get people locked up or court-martialed or anything like that.
And you don't have national attention on you so big right now, like him and the other parents of the other SEAL team.
So what is he? What's his take on the SEAL Team 6 thing?
Well, it's funny. He couldn't say too much because there was a trial pending that was going to be aired on C-SPAN a couple days later. In fact, I didn't even follow up on that. I've been so busy with so many other things. But him and the other parents of the other victims of, you know, that helicopter shoot down, 17 of them, none of them are buying the official story. I asked him personally, do you think that bin Laden was even captured? And of course, we know that wasn't the case. Bin Laden was reported dead in December of 2001, and they've been using a CIA lookalike ever since. But in any case, I asked him, oh boy. Sorry about that. I should have shut my phone off. I asked him if he bought the story. I know he didn't from the way he was talking. But, he said he couldn't go into it because the trial was still pending. He couldn't go into the details. But he did say this, that his son expressed to him, concern, to write out a will. He told him, Dad, there's things going on in this country. If you knew about, you'd be shocked. You know, I said, have you been in touch with the other parents? Have they indicated the same thing, that they're sons who got killed in this helicopter shoot down, that they were acting out of the ordinary? He says, yes, every one of them. In other words, they suspected their lives were in danger.
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, that's obviously too much of a coincidence that after this ridiculous story of killing bin Laden and throwing his body in the ocean,
according to Muslim custom. Yeah, right.
Exactly.
And like, they'd be concerned about that anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, that was quite the way to, they put the bookend on this, bin Laden 9/11 thing. I mean, it opens with a ridiculous story of guys who couldn't fly Cessnas taking down three skyscrapers with two planes, and it closes with, we just killed him and threw him in the ocean. Don't ask any more questions.
It's so ridiculous. It really is. It's just nonsense.
So here, let me give you some of the top 10 reasons why the U.S. should keep intervening in Ukraine. Okay, number 10 is, we lost Crimea. So why not lose the whole country? Number 9 is, for only $5 billion, we made a real mess. Imagine the mess we could make for $10 billion. Number 8 is, hearing Victoria Nuland say, F the EU alone was worth the $5 billion. More entertainment, please. Number 7 is, if we don't intervene, those knockout Ukraine girls will leave the West behind. And we don't want our behinds left, do we? Number 6, Ukraine is Europe's leading producer of two critically important natural resources, debt and poverty. Yeah. Number 5, the two sides of Ukraine hate each other's guts, so why don't we go over there and stand between them and let them both shoot at us? Number 4, the coup we supported was financed by Zionist Jewish oligarchs and led by Nazis, which presents an outstanding opportunity to continue to promote Zio-Nazi cooperation, bringing two old enemies together to make a fresh start hating somebody else, such as Arabs, Russians, Persians, and Muslims. Number 3 is, fight unemployment, put Operation Gladio snipers back to work. Number 2 is, after our brilliant successes in Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq,
brilliant,
what could possibly go wrong? And number 1 is, intervening in Ukraine could solve a wide variety of problems: debt, recession, racism, gridlock, poverty, drug abuse, unemployment, illegal immigration, partisanship, political corruption, by triggering World War III and eliminating the root cause of all of these issues, namely human life.
Yeah. You know, it's comical, but at the same time, it's pathetically true, every single bit of it.
Well, that's the thing is, to write comedy these days, all you have to do is notice what's going on. It's all so ridiculous. You can't make this stuff up.
I don't know what's more ridiculous, the fact that this stuff is so in your face or the fact that there's still so many people that just aren't getting it. I mean, come on. How long this stuff has been going on? We've been intervening in so many countries, screwing up their affairs, and usually these screw-ups are preceded by the very thing going on there. You know, they're not taking loans from the IMF, or they're not going along with the pressures from, the EU, or whatever,
Yeah, that's right. I was just reading this really good new book about the 1953 CIA coup that overthrew Mossadegh in Iran. It's called The Coup by Ervind Abrahamian. And you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. It's, they had rent-a-mobs, you know, snipers and rent-a-mobs and the whole nine yards. It's exactly what they're doing in Ukraine, what they're doing in Syria. You know, they haven't really changed their playbook.
How many times does this have to happen before people... Well, you know, quite frankly, if people haven't gotten it by now, I don't know. There'll be a few here and there that'll wake up, but for the most part, you know, there's no excuse for ignorance anymore. The whole Cold War was all about this kind of thing. Every time we intervened, it was always on behalf of some big multinational corporation or, the IMF, the World Bank, wanting to enslave a country into perpetual debt. That's all we did.
Yeah. And they lie about it. So, you know, ridiculously, you know, just in your face. And this book, The Coup, about this Iran coup in 53 is really good in that respect, because you can just... You know, the author is trying to be a neutral academic historian, but you can just tell that he's cringing as he describes, like, you know, it's like obvious what they wanted. They didn't want Iran to have any control over its own oil, because they were making huge piles of money by stealing all the oil from Iran and giving them peanuts. And that's what it was about. And they had to keep lying about, oh, this country is threatened by communism. And they just made up this ridiculous stuff.
Mossadegh actually wanted to model Iran, Iran's constitution after the U.S. constitution. He was anything but communist. He was anti-communist.
Well, that's right. Yeah. He was a little bit like Roosevelt in a sense. He was kind of a reformer, wanted to give the working person a better break. And he was a very honest and idealistic guy and a pretty darn skilled politician. So he was a real serious opponent of the empire, and they had to pull out all the stops, and they still barely got him.
Right. Yeah, the CIA went to great lengths. And that wasn't just for U.S. interests, British interests as well, as it turns out. The whole thing started with Britain. You know, what Mossadegh had done is... the Brits were taking 100% of their oil profits. And so Mossadegh said, oh, no, wait a minute. This is enough with this. This is our oil. He didn't even tell them, get out. You're not getting any more of it. He agreed to allow them to still keep 25%. They had no claim over it at all, no legitimate claim. But he was still willing to let them take 25%. But nope, they said, no way, we want all of it. We've been accustomed to getting all of it. We want all of it. So then they started calling Washington and, you know, struck up a deal. And next thing you know, the CIA is in there launching a coup.
That's right. And the Brits were just really pompous and racist. And, you know, they kept saying things like, well, the reason these crazy Iranians think that they should have control over their own oil is because they're Orientals, and they're very emotional, and they're just not rational.
Yeah. And then you look at the havoc that was wreaked on that country for the next several decades. They got rid of the, quote, dictator, Mossadegh, who was... elected legitimately by a landslide vote. You know, everybody was happy with him. And they replaced him with, of course, the Ayatollah there, and everything went to hell.
Yeah, well, actually, the Shah was pretty much the, you know, our man in Tehran.
And
When he got overthrown, you know, I remember I was like 20 years old or so in 1979, and I was already figuring out that, you know, we were the evil empire. So I was cheering for the Iranian Revolution. And frankly, Charles, I haven't stopped cheering. I think the Iranian Revolution is getting the same bad press for the same reason that Mossadegh did. And the people, you know, everything you're reading about what's going on in Iran in the mainstream media here in the U.S. is pretty much all lies. You know, like, they have honest elections. We don't. You know, our elections are programmed in Diebold voting machines. They have hand-counted paper ballots.
Actually, you said pretty much. Do you know of some instances that aren't lies? I haven't found any yet.
Well, you know, you see the propaganda against Iran. You dig through it, and they claim, oh, these people, you know, here's somebody who's being persecuted, you know, and why were they being persecuted? Well, maybe they're working for the CIA, or maybe they were just an innocent, you know, Christian evangelist, right? Who knows? But the bottom line is that I think that the top level of leadership in Iran right now has a certain amount of integrity and idealism. And that's a lot more than you can say about top leadership in almost any other country.
Yeah. Unbelievable. As we talk here, I get questions coming in via text. Do you want to take a question now? Or?
Yeah, sure. Bring them on.
Yeah, this comes from Merlin in the UK, and he asks, why does the U.S. continue to drone bomb It seems to be a form of terrorism.
Yeah, it seems to be. I mean, come on. Drone murders are the most cowardly and despicable form of terrorism that I can have imagined. You know, if you want to go fight somebody, you know, go fight them face to face and, you know, shoot at them when they're shooting at you. Give them a fair chance and, you know, put your own butt on the line. But these pathetic, you know, wimps who are sitting behind video consoles murdering people and mostly murdering innocent civilians and political enemies of the U.S. or the Bankster Empire. These people are the most sickening, disgusting, cowardly terrorists. And just because they're dressed up in U.S. military uniforms doesn't mean that they aren't the scum of the earth who deserve to be taken down to Guantanamo and waterboarded, if not executed.
Yeah, that's all they're doing. That's all they've ever done. Is whore for the big corporations and the big banks. That's it. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, I respect to a certain extent somebody in the U.S. military, and they're sent over to like Afghanistan or something or Iraq, and they're given a job to do, and they try to do it honestly.
Right.
You know, they don't start, you know, raping and torturing and doing insane things like so many of our troops do. But there are some honest ones who are trying to do the job right, and I kind of respect that. Their butts are on the line. They're putting it on the line. But these drone warriors sitting behind video consoles in Nevada slaughtering innocent people. I mean, God, you know, if I told you what I would like to do to those people, I would be getting visits from the federales. So I'm going to keep my mouth shut.
You know what? You know where they can go. But anyway, you know, this is no accident. They've been raising this up and coming generation of kids now with video games that mimic, you know, what goes on in behind these consoles. To dehumanize it, you know. So now, when they get into the military and they're told to control remotely these drones, to them it's like playing a video game. The personal touch is gone. They don't see what their actions are really doing. They're not right there being a part of it. It's just like watching the video screen when they're playing a game. You know what I mean? And that's no exaggeration. The Pentagon has literally been working with these video game production companies for that very purpose. That's admitted.
Well, that's right. It's part of this effort to make, you know, program people to kill, which has always been the hardest part of military science. And SLA Marshall was the researcher who discovered that only, you know, 10-15% of the troops on the front lines of World War II were actually trying to kill the enemy, and everybody else was shooting over their heads or, you know, shooting into the ground or you know, helping somebody else reload or whatever, but they weren't really trying to kill because, you know, he discovered that normal human beings just really don't like to take human life except in a sort of defensive emergency. So post-World War II, they put the psychologists to work doing conditioning to try to turn ordinary young people into killers. And they found that with this Pavlov-style conditioning of, you know, over and over and over, you know, shooting at a very lifelike-looking image of a person, and then also being exposed to racist, brutal, dehumanizing talk about this particular person's group. Like, in Vietnam, it was the Gooks, and now it's the Hajis or what have you. So they could dehumanize their targets and turn the people into sort of, you know, killer robots. And this kind of programming, which does include now video game type, you know, simulacrums of murder, is what's been used to turn, you know, ordinary people who didn't used to do most of the killing in wars. It usually was the psychopathic 2%. You know, 2% of male Americans are psychopaths who just as soon kill you as they'd swat a fly. And in past wars, those people did almost all of the killing. But now, with this new technology, they can brainwash ordinary, you know, people with souls into becoming killers, and that just damages their souls. They come home from wars, and they, you know, we get suicides and drug addiction and all kinds of horrible social problems. It's a complete disaster.
And there's a great effort to either minimize or just outright cover up that fact that, you know, there have been a lot of suicides. There's been a lot of abandonment too. This was going on in Iraq. It's still going on in Afghanistan, where soldiers are just up and leaving their posts, realizing what a scam this whole thing is and saying, forget about it.
Well, here's to them. You know, I'm cheering for any soldier that's deserting their post in this evil scam of a war. And it's so clear now with 9/11, you know, once you get what 9/11 was, that just pretty well symbolizes the evil of the whole project.
Yeah, absolutely. What are some of the, actually, before we even do that, I guess we have another question that came in here. This is from Mike in California. He asks, well, first he says, I wish I had a professor like Dr. Barrett in college. Yeah, me too. Although I must say, I had some pretty good professors. I had a couple that really encouraged me. This one guy, really nice guy, he wound up dying from kidney failure not too long after I graduated, but he was always encouraging me. He says, you know what I see in you? I don't see a history teacher. I see a political science professor. You know, he was always trying to get me to go on and get my master's and PhD, and I wish I had, but...
Well, you're like me now. You're doing education by other means.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So this is still education. But if things had played out different, I didn't have kids, you know, I would have done that. I would have enjoyed it. But I still like what I'm doing. In fact, I'm reaching more people this way than, you know, in the classroom.
And you can say what you think. The problem with the universities these days is it's reaching the point that there are more and more taboos. You know, political correctness has taken over in so many of these areas. 20 years ago, it wasn't nearly this bad. People were questioning the JFK assassination, getting away with it. There was a certain amount of real free speech, I think, that opened up on campuses in the 70s, 80s, and was starting to go downhill in the 90s. And then 9/11 came along, and boom, now everybody's really watching what they say.
Right, right. But anyway, he goes on to ask, he says, how did your students feel about you? Were they real supportive, or did they kind of turn against you because of, you know, saying things like, you know, 9/11 was an inside job or whatever? How did they view you when all this had broken out?
Well, you know, before the big witch hunt, before I was all over the news, the students were cool with everything I was doing, and I wasn't really leaning hard on 9/11 at all at that point. The only time I really brought it up in class was in a folklore class. We were talking about, you know, we did 1 week on urban legends and conspiracy theories. And so, yep. You know, I just put out, like, what, you know, what the so-called conspiracy theorists say and what Snopes.com says in rebuttal, and let the students figure it out. And if they, you know, if they tried hard enough, they would figure out that the conspiracy theorists were right and that Snopes was lying. But I didn't tell them that. They had to figure it out. Some did, some didn't, and didn't lean on it. And it, you know, the students loved it. There was actually one guy in that class who was the grandson of a famous Wisconsin Republican governor, and he loved it. You know, I didn't have problems with any of these people. And then I got witch hunted. And so that drew a lot of attention to my class, and it brought a lot of students signing up just to, you know, because of the controversy. So I had almost 200 students in the class that usually had 30. It was an intro to Islam class. And those students they loved it. You know, I got very, very high ratings. This local student newspaper, which really wasn't on my side, but they had to write their big article that, you know, I think the headline was Barrett gets high marks from students. And so even the ones who had signed up just to try and give me a hard time ended up, I think, appreciating the class. It really wasn't a class about 9/11. It was an intro to Islam class. So there was only 1 week on the so-called war on terror. And during that week, we, you know, looked at these different perspectives, looking at, you know, the neocon perspective, the realist perspective, and the perspective of Muslims. And 3/4 plus of the world's Muslims are convinced that 9/11 was an inside job. So if you're doing an Islam class, you have to talk about that. You know, it's one of the perspectives you really should present. And yeah. Guess what? I'll bet that 3 out of 4, you know, maybe 9 out of 10 people teaching intro to Islam in this country are afraid to even tell their students that the vast majority of the world's Muslims think 9/11 was an inside job. Now, how can you not talk, if you're teaching about this, you know, Muslims and the so-called war on terror and so on, how can you not mention that?
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Exactly. You know.
But yeah, I never, you know, I'm not trying to push my views on students. You know, that's one reason I actually like doing this alternative media thing.
Your job as a teacher is simply to get them to think. That's all.
Yeah, just make them think, and then they can take that whichever direction they want.
And as long as there's some credence to these crazy conspiracy ideas, you are obligated to present it. You know, I'm into I don't know if you ever heard of diffusionism, but it's an idea in historical circles that, you know, Columbus was not the first one to discover America, you know, that pretty much every ancient old world culture had been here at one time or other. And the evidence for that is actually overwhelming. I don't know if you ever looked into it, but I've asked the same question there.
Well, yeah, was there like a Chinese anchor that got dropped in the Pacific off our coast in 2,000 years ago?
Yeah, absolutely. Everywhere, you know, North America, South America. Anyway, these evidences are so abundant and so downright irrefutable. I mean, just in your face, obvious. My question is, why don't the historians, why don't the professors just mention this in passing as a point of curiosity? They totally blackball this stuff. They don't address it at all. It's astonishing. And yet they call this an education. They're not being suited with all the necessary bits and pieces to make a real legitimate critical judgment about historical events. They're only given a skewed, narrow view of things. And it's really set them off in the wrong direction. You know, it's sad.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the reasons that they don't admit that there was all this context, and I agree with you, I think there was, is that that conflicts with this myth of Columbus discovering America in 1492. And even at the university professor level, people are so conditioned by these myths that it unconsciously skews the way they look at evidence. That's why studying the creation of myths and public myths is so interesting, because that's really what governs the way that communities perceive reality. You know, that's why the 9/11 Commission report was written by Philip Zelikow, who describes himself as an expert in the creation and maintenance of public myths. He knows that communities define themselves and limit the way they can think and see the world based on these sacred stories that give a foundation to their communities. You know, for instance, the myth of the story of Jesus, the sacred narrative of Jesus, which I'm not saying it's not true, but it's mythical. It's a myth in the sense it's a sacred story. That's the sacred story of Christianity. It divides time into a before and an after, and the after is the world of Christendom, which we live in. Likewise, the myth of 1776 and the American Revolution is a sacred story of America. That's where America came from.
Yeah.
Divides time into before the United States and now, the world we live in. And so Philip Zelikow said, you know, and he wrote this article in 1998 in Foreign Affairs magazine. He said, you know, if we had a massive terror attack that like a new Pearl Harbor that destroyed the World Trade Center, it would divide time into a before and an after and on and on and on. So he did this whole article analyzing what would happen post 9/11, and he published it in 1998. And so the thing is that these myths really run our minds, and the myth of 1492 and the discovery has prevented people from really wrapping their minds around the fact that all these other people were running around America before that.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, you might not want to go down that road, and I don't want to get up on a religious tangent, but, you know, you seem hesitant to say that it was a myth, so I'll say it for you. I was also a theology major. I was a big supporter of the Bible and the myth of, the story of Christ. And I have to say, Kevin, after years and years of studying that, I studied myself right out of it. Because once you really subject it to critical analysis, Bible believers don't do that. You know, they'll just look at it for what for what the minister says. Usually they'll just cite one or two passages. And as long as you read those passages out of context and don't compare them with other seemingly parallel passages that actually aren't, but conflict with that one, everything's fine. The structure will stand firm. But the minute you start to, approach it from that angle, gee, I wonder if this book really is infallible or if it does contradict itself, you start opening up a whole new world, and it falls apart. It can't withstand.
Yeah, I think it's possible to go too far in that direction, though. Although, who knows? I mean, God knows what the real ultimate truth of all these things could be. But with the Bible, the way I look at the Christian Bible, the New Testament, the Injil is what the Muslims call it. It seems to me that it reads a lot like a kind of oral tradition that then got written down. Yeah. And oral traditions can sometimes have a lot of truth to them, and then they can also get kind of mythologized.
Sure. And, point. Yeah. There's so many problems, though, that you can't put you just can't put your total confidence in it. You don't know which parts belong there, which don't. It certainly is not infallible. That just has to go out the window, that one.
Yeah, this business of scriptures being infallible is a kind of an interesting thing, because I think it does lead people down the wrong path sometimes, because they think that they understand what the scripture means, and therefore they are absolutely right. They take this notion that the scripture is the perfect absolute word of God, and then they imagine that their interpretation of it is equally infallible, and that makes them very pompous and dangerous.
Fanaticism, sure. I'll tell you what, we got to cut to a break, just a short break. When we get back, we got a caller on the line, too, has an important question for you. So stick with us, folks. Be right back.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive. But there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit UNICEFUSA.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. Again, our guest is Kevin Barrett. We got a caller waiting. Before we go to him, just to finish up, did you have anything more on the religion thing? Maybe we'll have to have you on sometime. We can just talk about religion.
Yeah. The short version is that I actually am a practicing Muslim, and I do believe in all of the religious revelations, monotheism, and I think Buddhism is probably also a revealed religion. I think there's a reason that these have been preserved, but I do think that the language that they speak in is symbolic, and that the ultimate reality, which the monotheistic tradition is this absolute oneness, which gives rise to everything. It's the source of everything in the universe. That's what we call God, and it might be called something else in another tradition. So the short version is, yes, I actually do believe in religion, and specifically in monotheism as interpreted through Islam. I think Islam has the most straightforward description of this take on ultimate reality, but we could go on all night about that. So that's my short version. Let's move on and take a call.
Sure. One comment I want to make. At least in Islam, I don't believe you have such a thing called Islamic Zionism.
No, there's no Islamic Zionism.
Yeah, you have Christian Zionism, and they're worse than the Jewish Zionists, if you ask me.
Well, they are. And, you wonder why this is, because honestly, I've read the Christian Bible. It's beautiful. I agree with you. I don't know if every word could possibly be absolutely right. That I don't see how that could be. But right. It's a very, the Jesus that we get in the Bible is a beautiful teacher of peace. He's a healer, a great guy. So why are they claiming that this guy's going to come back and nuke everybody as soon as they finish exterminating the Palestinians?
Actually, I think love the neighbor was a mistranslation. I think he meant to say bomb your neighbor. Isn't that right?
Maybe that was it. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, let's go to our caller here. Rock Cash is his name that he's going by. So, welcome to the show, Rock.
Hey, how are you, Charles? And hello, Kevin.
Hi.
Kevin, my question to you is, with you being a professor, do you think that our educational system is really up to par to where people are pretty much systemized not to question and just follow? Because if you follow the curriculum, you'll, get your PhD. If you don't follow your curriculum, of course you're going to get attacked. And that seems to be the norm. And going back to the Bible and the Quran and stuff like that, the Bible, it's a two-part question. The Bible, there was no such word as Jew in the Bible. There were the Judeans. And the translation of, the Zionist is a completely different thing. There's a difference between the two peoples. The Judeans and the Zionists, or the Jews of today and the Jews of yesterday, are two completely different people. And the Palestinians would actually be the Judeans of the time that converted to Christianity and Islam. But anyways, it's a two-part question. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think you're right that the whole educational system is designed more to inculcate myths and produce conformity than it is to teach people to think critically. Even though there's that lip service given to teaching critical thinking, my experience has been that there, you don't want to cross these certain lines and think critically about the really important stuff, or you can get yourself into trouble. And as far as the Judeans, it's very complicated. The people that we think of now as Jews or Judeans or what have you back in those days were, there were a lot of different schools of them. And likewise, there were a lot of different schools of early Christianity as well. But it's absolutely right that the descendants of those people in Palestine that the Bible talks about, and that those would be today's Palestinians. The Zionists who've settled in occupied Palestine are the descendants of Eastern Europeans. The Khazar tribe converted to Judaism in the Middle Ages, and those people probably are the bulk of the European Jews who have no real Palestinian ancestry. So what's really going on in Israel, or occupied Palestine, as I prefer to call it, is a European settler colonial project, a little bit like French Algeria or British Rhodesia, where folks from Europe have gone and used their superior firepower to take over somebody else's land. And they've been thrown out of Algeria, they've been thrown out of Rhodesia, and they're going to get thrown out of Palestine. It's impossible to keep these settler colonial projects going in today's world, but they're giving it their best shot because they've got the central banks, they've got tremendous political power and financial power, and they completely own the Western media. So they're doing their best to keep this settler colony in Palestine going. And I would give it another maybe 20, 30 years.
There was a statement actually where Henry Kissinger had actually told a New York Times reporter that Israel won't be around in another 10 years.
I think Henry might have been trying to scare up some money from the big Zionist donors. So he might have been unduly alarmist. But I hope he's right, because seriously, this is just, every day there are more kids shot down. I just got an email from one of my friends over there. He's a professor, Mazen Kumsaya, and he just told us that today's news is that the Israeli army murdered seven Palestinians in the last 48 hours. One of them is an 18-year-old Saji Darwish, who's a student at the university where Mazen teaches. And you know, they just shoot these people down. They shoot kids for sport. Now, Chris Hedges wrote about witnessing Israeli soldiers barking out insults on a bullhorn. So these little kids would come out to throw rocks at them, and then they could shoot them in the gut for sport. British Medical Journal documented 600-plus such incidents in a relatively restricted period of time. And not one of those soldiers who was shooting Palestinian kids for sport ever got prosecuted. So this is a really ugly situation, and we never hear any of these things in our Zionist-controlled media. I guess you hear that if you listen to shows like this. But I would be happy if Kissinger was right and Israel was gone in 10 years.
It would be one of the best things that's ever happened to this planet in a long time.
Well, I guess we're not owned by Zionists here.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for the call, caller. I got some other questions here.
You're welcome.
To get to. Thanks a lot. Okay, let's see. We've got a few others that have come in. This is from Paul from, wow. Oh, okay, Venice, Florida. I thought it was Venice, Italy. You never know. You never know who's listening in. Since we're, you know, internet-based, literally anybody around the world could be listening in. Anyway, he says, do you still give credence to the 9/11 no planes theory? I'm sorry if I am wrong thinking that you did at one time.
Oh, well, yeah, actually, you would be wrong because, no, I've never endorsed or proclaimed any credence in any no planes theory in general. I think you have to take it, you know, issue by issue.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think, well, I don't think that the original passenger planes crashed in any of the alleged crash locations.
I agree.
So, but I do think that something probably did, at least in some of those locations. The towers, I think that probably what those were drones. I think military drones hit the towers.
Well, and, you know, Fox's Mark Birnbach, for example, said live of that morning, of course, you know, you don't hear about this anymore, but you can see it on YouTube. You know, he's reporting live, and he said, regarding the second plane, he said, I was in an adjacent building, and it flew right by the window that I was sitting at. I got a very good look at it, meaning, you know, flight 175, nod, nod, wink, wink. And he said, whatever it was, it wasn't a commercial airliner. He said, it didn't have any windows on it. It looked more like a cargo plane. Mm-hmm. It had an unusual blue logo, but he said, you know, it was a dark color. He says it definitely wasn't a commercial airliner. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's probably how it was done there, at least. I was just interviewing David Griscom today. David Griscom is a very respected physicist, and he's looking for somebody to debate him about 9/11. He wants to find a physicist who will argue that the official story does not violate the laws of physics, and we're not having any luck finding any physicists that can say that. Anyway, Griscom believes that he's kind of figured out how the plane switcheroos were done, and you know, the kind of obvious thing is that the two planes that supposedly hit the towers, which would be flight 175, and what was the other one? The first one that hit the North Tower was it's escaping my mind. Anyway, or 11, yeah, 11 and 175. Those two flights crossed paths within a minute or two of each other, over an Air Force base.
Air Force Base.
So he's pretty sure that there was a switch done and that drones went on and buildings.
If you ever looked at Operation Northwoods, which was another plan back in the early 60s they were going to launch to, you know, fake terrorist attacks, to blame it on Castro to facilitate an invasion of Cuba. One of the scenarios that they were going to undertake was that very type of thing. They were going to take planes and have them land at a military base and switch them with drones. That exact same scenario.
That's right.
Have the drones slam into buildings or whatever.
Yeah, and I think we can be pretty sure that it must have been something like that. At least we can be pretty sure it wasn't 767s that hit the towers, because these planes were going too fast to have flown accurately, possibly too fast to have even flown at all at sea level without falling apart.
And that's all the more true when you come to the Pentagon, you know, to have a plane of that size with powerful engines to come that close to the front lawn without ripping it up at the Pentagon. I'm sorry. It's just, you know. And then you realize that Hani Hanjour, the alleged pilot, wasn't even competent enough to fly a commercial airliner. He couldn't even fly a Cessna, you know, never mind. His own instructor said, I'll never go in the air with you again, just a few weeks before 9/11. You know, he said, you just don't have what it takes to be an airline pilot. Anyway, let's go to, we got another question here. This is from Mr. Got Rocks. He calls himself in Vermont. He says, does Professor Barrett have a comment on the current challenge to NIST over the WTC-7 structural element omissions recently filed formally by attorney William Pepper? Are you familiar with that story?
You know, yeah, kind of, but not, I haven't interviewed William Pepper on that yet. And so I'm not too sure about any details. Maybe the person knows more than I do, actually.
Yeah.
It sounds good. I mean, anything William Pepper is filing is good as far as I'm concerned. He's very careful. I've discussed this stuff with him for years. We've been talking about what kind of lawsuits could be filed, and he's very cautious. He thinks that you don't want to file a lawsuit unless you know where the venue is going to end up, where, you know, what judge you're going to end up before. You need to think it all through strategically, and he's turned down some potential 9/11 lawsuits for that reason in the past. So the fact that he's actually picking this up tells me that it actually has some prospect of having some success.
Yeah, I'm actually not familiar with that one either. I didn't even know that William Pepper was involved in anything related to 9/11.
Well, you know, I didn't know this had actually been filed. I've seen emails about this William Pepper lawsuit, but I didn't know that it was actually moving forward. I didn't see any official press releases, so I'm going to have to check back and see what I've been missing.
Yeah, that's new to me too. Although I haven't been following that specifically. There's so many things that I'm researching lately. I'm all over the map. It's hard to keep up with everything all at once. Anyway, we just got maybe 7 or 8 minutes left. In the remaining time, are there any really pressing issues lately that you've written about on Veterans Today that you'd like to share? Anything that jumps out of that comes to mind? Or?
Well, you know, like I said, I've been doing more satire and sort of dark humor, because if you can't laugh at this stuff, you go crazy. You know, and I think that also, you know, not only keeps us sane, but when somebody who doesn't understand this stuff looks at our work, when they see that we have a sense of humor, I think that actually helps a little bit.
Yeah. I try to bring that element in myself, you know, in the shows I host. I have a saying that our world today is such a big joke, you just got to laugh at it.
You might
as well laugh at it. It's such a joke. And it is. It's a joke, unfortunately. It's a very pathetic joke.
And if you tell the truth, you better make it funny or they'll kill you.
Yeah.
I've been doing, you know, this Ukraine situation is just so ridiculous. Throwing all this money into screwing with the Russians, there's no reason to do that.
Yeah.
You know, there's no reason to be running around promoting, coups d'etat and destabilizing these countries. It's just not necessary. And there's always blowback, like with overthrowing Mossadegh. You know, so you've got the Shah for a couple of decades, and then he gets overthrown, and you've got an Iran that's really not going to cooperate with the U.S. for a long time.
Yeah.
So what's the point? You know, what did we get from doing that? You know, it's a huge waste of the taxpayers' money, a waste of energy. Strategically, it doesn't get anywhere. You know, moving back to something closer to George Washington's foreign policy, you know, being...
Well, but from their perspective, it was booming success, because it served to destabilize the country, and there was no advancing for it. You know what I'm saying?
They can call it a success. They can say, look, we're really overthrowing countries' governments that don't cooperate with us, and so that's going to put pressure on other countries to cooperate with us and take IMF loans and this kind of stuff. They can say that, and then they're going to keep collecting their paychecks from us taxpayers. But I don't think it's actually serving the national interest.
Well, they're not concerned with the national interest as far as we go.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, right now, what would serve the national interest would be taking, you know, military money, cutting the military budget in half, or maybe by even 90% plus, and working on infrastructure here. You know, we've really been neglecting our infrastructure. The one thing that governments actually can spend money on that actually does some good is infrastructure.
Yeah.
But because you can't get the private sector to all put in to, you know, build the roads and have a postal service and a, you know, communications infrastructure and all that stuff. I mean, that's what governments do. And our bridges are crumbling. We had one collapse here in Wisconsin a few years ago. You know, we don't have decent trains in this country. Everybody else has high speed trains, and sure, our Amtrak trains are from 30 years old. They're falling apart.
Even our roads, you know, across Europe, they're using this rubber impregnated tar, you know, so when they pave the roads, it stretches from cold to warm seasons and it doesn't crack. Whereas over here, they're having to repair them constantly, especially here in New England. You know, they no sooner pave it, the following year it's ready to do again because the, you know, the frost heaves just keep cracking it. They don't fix things with, you know, the proper way. They don't care. They're not interested in quality. There's no money in that, you know.
Well, all the money's going over to, you know, Ukraine. It's I guess I saw another satirical proposal that maybe Detroit wants to join the Ukraine so they can get some of that money to rebuild.
Yeah. Ah, boy. What a world.
Yeah.
I've often said I wish somebody would pinch me and wake me up and tell me this has been a bad dream. You know, it just can't be this messed up, but it is. But then again, Kevin, you know, if you look at history, the only exception today is that we're seeing this stuff going on now on a grand scale globally. In the past, you know, you had corruption always, but it was more localized. You know, now you have this interlocking grid network on a global scale. You know, when a scam takes place, the effects of it affects everybody, you know.
Yeah, and we do have this kind of world government project, call it the New World Order, if you will. They're concentrating their finance capital in fewer and fewer hands and paying technocrats to figure out how to manipulate people globally. And you know, ultimately, they're trying to get a one world government. But I don't know if it's going to work. There's resistance everywhere. The wars in post 9/11 didn't really get them very far. They destabilized Israel's enemies, but they didn't really accomplish much. And now Israel is facing Hezbollah that defeated them in 2006 and has all kinds of rockets way beyond what they had then. So everybody in Israel now is getting a foreign passport. So the next time Hezbollah starts firing rockets into Israel, they're all going to clear out and head for Europe. Maybe they'll stay there. So the empire isn't really doing all that well. You know, they keep coming up with these strategies for destabilizing countries and doing false flags to con the world into going along with it. But I don't know if the world is ultimately all that controllable. You know, Brzezinski lamented that it's easier to kill a million people than to control a million people these days. And I don't think they're doing
that.
Yeah. the good side of that is it is fairly hard to control people. And yeah, I think more people than ever are seeing through the nonsense and looking at alternative media shows like this. Press TV, Russia Today, you know, people are, I've seen maybe, you know, 40 or 50 articles, I think, in the last few days giving the truthful alternative view of Ukraine. I don't think the American people are in a huge hurry to go to war with Russia. So it's, you know, it's not hopeless. It could be a lot worse. I mean, we could be living in a much more brainwashed and militaristic country than we are.
Absolutely. I tell you what, we got time for one more question here. This comes from John in Ohio, when he asks, does Dr. Barrett think that the U.S. is an evil empire and that, like Rome, it is doomed to fail?
Short answer would be yes. I mean, that's not all the U.S. is, but there is this imperial apparatus that has really taken over post-World War II, and it is evil. It's, you know, it depends on lies and mass murder to get more and more concentrated power. And that's evil. I mean, what, you know, what else could possibly be?
Wait, I thought we were fighting the axis of evil, and then prior to that, the evil empire.
Yeah. I think empire in general is pretty evil from the viewpoint of people who are not running it.
But, you know, these terms they use to sucker us, you know, it's like they're writing a comic book strip or a comic strip, you know. Evil empire. Oh, you expect to see Darth Vader walking by with his robe. You know?
Yeah.
Will the real evil empire please stand up? That's the question.
Yeah, well, like the old Pogo comic strip said, we've met the enemy and he is us.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, I just got a message here. I thought we had to stop at 5:00, but I guess we actually do have a few more minutes, so we don't have to cut off so early. Trying to think what else has been going on in the news here. Well, we got 2 more minutes, I guess. Anything else going on in the news? What do you think of the Boston bombing? I don't believe I've talked to you since then.
Yeah, boy, that, I thought that was just, you know, once again, they're doing it right in our faces. You know, obvious false flag. I don't know about this business of, you know, staged people, you know, staged blood and all that stuff. I'm not 100% convinced of that, but I am convinced that, you know, when you see the pictures of those guys in Kraft International hats and uniforms with the backpacks, and the FBI tells us that the bomb is in this particular blown up backpack, and that was the backpack that was on the Kraft International guy, yeah, not on the Tsarnaev brothers. You know, we got a problem here, and now all these, they're killing all these people. You know, they kill the key witness, Todorov. The FBI is interrogating him, and they, you know, he gets shot like 8 times, and final point blank kill shot to the head, execution style murder of a guy in FBI custody. You know, there's something really wrong here.
Yeah, very familiar pattern, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's that was mind-boggling. I mean, I thought that was going a little too far. And also, it appears that they just, you know, killed the older Tsarnaev brother, ran him over a bunch of times, shot him down, and ran him over. And it looked like they wanted to kill the other one too. But now he's on trial, and they're pushing the death penalty so they can get him to plead and not put on a defense,
because obviously,
right. I mean, an honest defense would probably get him off and get Kraft International in serious trouble, but I don't know if there's any lawyers that have the guts to do that.
Yeah. Anyway, I want to thank you for taking the time out and coming on the show and sharing with us. We'll have to have you on again sometime. Once again, folks, his website is Truth Jihad. In fact, I don't even think I mentioned that earlier, truthjihad.com, and then of course you can catch his articles on Veterans Today. Any other websites you wanted to refer people to? Or
well, truthjihad.com gets you pretty much everywhere, and I do like Press TV as well. I write for them and show up on their TV shows a lot.
Oh, great! I didn't realize that. That's great. Do you include the articles that you write for Veterans Today on your Truth Jihad website as well? Or?
Yeah, people can find their way to that. If you go to truthjihad.com. Just look in the left margin, and you can click on links to the articles at Veterans Today or Press TV.
All right, there you go, folks. So, we'll have to follow your work there on those sites. And like I said, we'll get you back on again sometime.
Okay, well, thanks, Charles. Keep up the good work.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Okay, folks, have a great week. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll have some more great guests for you coming up, so stay tuned. Take care.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.